This is the podcast for the criminal law class on the topic of proving the elements of an offense. And the cornerstone of the American judicial system is that the government must prove every element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And the Supreme Court has made that clear, the leading case being In re Winship, in which it said that this principle, which is part of the due process protection for every defendant, requires that the government prove the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant need not offer any proof, and indeed can stand completely silent, and if the government doesn't establish every element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt, then the conviction will be reversed. Even if, and this is where the Jackson case comes in United States versus Jackson, even if the court believes that the defendant is guilty, if the government fails to prove some aspect or element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt, then a verdict of not guilty must be returned by the jury, or the court can enter an order, either the trial court or, in the Jackson case, you see the appellate court finding that there was insufficient evidence. In Jackson itself, the issue of identity was the key point there, that the government failed to establish that the Aaron Jackson who had a prior conviction was in fact the Aaron Jackson who possessed the ammunition. Now, that type of evidence could be easily acquired, but the government, for whatever reason, failed to introduce that evidence. And on reviewing the conviction, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals said that there was not sufficient evidence of the identity of the person who had been convicted before and the person possessing the ammunition to establish that they were one and the same, and therefore the government failed to prove that element of the crime, that in fact it had brought the correct defendant before the court. Now, what is it that constitutes proof beyond a reasonable doubt? Well, there are any number of different types of evidence that can be offered. The general division of evidence into two categories is that there is direct evidence, for example, eyewitness testimony, a statement of a defendant, and then there is circumstantial evidence, and that essentially is everything else. So circumstantial evidence would be evidence that is used by the trier of fact, the jury, or the judge, if the judge is in charge of the case, that is used by the trier of fact to infer, in other words, to draw an inference from, to draw a conclusion from that evidence, that if you have a certain piece of evidence, that if you have tire marks, for example, or DNA evidence, that is evidence that can be used to infer that there was a skid or an accident, or that the DNA establishes the identity of the defendant. So circumstantial evidence or direct evidence, they are both sufficient to establish proof beyond a reasonable doubt to show that the person in fact committed the crime. Now, what is it that constitutes reasonable doubt, or how would that be defined? Well, this is a problem for the courts because it's easy to state beyond a reasonable doubt, but what exactly is beyond a reasonable doubt? Well, it's not just any potential theory. The government doesn't have to disprove every possible theory that could be offered by a defendant, and so in the People versus Salmonson case, you see there the Michigan court is stating that, well, the defendant was parked next to the side of the road and had a very high blood alcohol level. Had he driven the car, well, the government presented evidence that the engine was warm, he was present in a place where the car had to have been driven there, and therefore that was sufficient to infer that he had driven the vehicle. Now, the defendant's argument was, well, but there could have been someone else driving the car, or he may have gotten drunk in the car. Well, these are all theories. The government doesn't have to affirmatively disprove them. It just has to put on sufficient evidence so that a reasonable trier of fact could return a verdict of guilty. And so it's not saying that there is no other possibility, but instead just that there is sufficient evidence to establish that the defendant, in fact, engaged in the conduct, had the requisite intent, you meet all the elements of the crime to prove that, beyond a reasonable doubt, this person committed the offense. So it's not that you have to have overwhelming evidence, but you do have to have sufficient evidence. What is sufficient? Well, that's, of course, up to the jury as an initial matter, and then the courts in reviewing it. Now, it's important to point out here that when the jury reviews the evidence, the benefit of the doubt goes to the defendant, that it's the government's burden to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and if there is a reasonable basis to find that the proof is insufficient, then the jury must return a verdict of not guilty. If there is a guilty verdict, then on review by the Court of Appeals or by a state Supreme Court or the United States Supreme Court, the benefit at that point goes to the government. Why? Because the defendant has been convicted. So that once there is a conviction, then the benefit of the doubt, the reasonable inferences from the evidence go in favor of the government, go in favor of the verdict. Why? That's what the jury has assessed by returning its verdict of guilty. Now, that does not mean that the government always wins. The Jackson case, for example, the Court of Appeals said that there really was insufficient evidence of identity, and therefore no reasonable juror should have returned a verdict of guilty. Well, in fact, 12 people did return that verdict, but the court is looking at it in hindsight, of course, and saying, no, the jury made a mistake, and it's not just that they made a mistake that the Court of Appeals disagrees with. Well, we would have gone the other way. But the Court of Appeals is saying there was insufficient evidence. There was not proof beyond a reasonable doubt of an element of the offense. Therefore, the conviction must be overturned. Now, how do you define reasonable doubt? Well, that's an issue that courts have struggled with from time immemorial. And the Rimmer case shows here a jury instruction in the case, and this is where the judge is going to tell the jury, here is the burden that the government must meet. And in that jury instruction, it included the sentence, reasonable doubt does not mean a doubt that may arise from possibility. In the Supreme Court cases that have considered reasonable doubt instructions, the Cage versus Louisiana and Victor versus Nebraska cases, the judges in those cases use moral certainty in there. How do you define beyond a reasonable doubt? The definitions are often circuitous, that they simply say reasonable doubt is a doubt that is reasonable. Well, in Rimmer, the statement by the trial court that reasonable doubt does not mean a doubt that may arise from possibility, what the court there meant was it's not just any hypothetical possibility, but there has to be some basis for that possibility to rise to the level of reasonable doubt about the defendant's guilt, and therefore the jury should return a verdict of not guilty. What the Tennessee court said in that case is, well, looking at this in isolation, maybe it's problematic, and notice that the court says you shouldn't use that line in the future because it could be confusing to a jury, but what in the context of the entire instruction, it was clear to the jury that, in fact, what was needed was not just any possibility, but there had to be some basis for the jury to return a verdict of not guilty. And so reasonable doubt is, well, very difficult to instruct a jury on, but it is the government's burden, and that, of course, is the key. Now, does the jury have to return a verdict of guilty? Well, the jury has the power to nullify the law, so even if it is properly instructed and finds that, based on the facts, that there is sufficient proof to hold the defendant liable, to find the defendant guilty of the crime, a jury can nullify. A jury can decide not to convict a defendant and return a verdict of not guilty. Why is that so efficacious? Well, it's because of the double jeopardy protection, that once a jury returns a verdict of not guilty, a defendant cannot be tried again on that charge. The government cannot appeal it. Even if a jury were to make a mistake, that at that point in time, once the not guilty verdict is returned, that's the end of the case. And so the jury has the power to nullify, but importantly, it is not instructed on that power, and in fact defendants in any number of jurisdictions have asked that the jury be instructed on that, and the courts routinely deny that instruction because while it's a power that the jury has, it is not a proper application of the law. Nor may, under the ethics rules, an attorney ask a jury to return a verdict of not guilty against the weight of the evidence. If that would be improper, that's asking a jury to act against the law. Now, even though a defense lawyer cannot do that directly, can you appeal to a jury's emotions? Well, certainly defense lawyers will do that, and sometimes they're successful. Now, what is it that the jury has to decide beyond a reasonable doubt? Well, that's the elements of a crime. And what are the elements of the crime? Those are the different components of it that are identified today by statute in the vast majority of cases, the parts of the statute that the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt to show when putting them all together that the defendant engaged in conduct that violates the law. In the Richardson versus United States case, you see how important statutory interpretation is to figuring out exactly what those elements are. In Richardson, you had a defendant charged with a continuing criminal enterprise involving a long-term criminal gang distributing drugs. And under the statute, it would require the government to prove among the elements of the offense that the drug violation was part of a continuing series of violations. So the key phrase there is series of violations. What does the jury have to find? The prosecution argued that all the jurors have to find is a series, that there's enough evidence of different violations that put together they constitute a series, and lower courts have said that series equals three, so at least three violations, and the Supreme Court was willing to accept that. So the government said all they had to prove was a series. The defense argued not only do you have to prove the series, but actually also an element of the crime is proof beyond a reasonable doubt of those violations. So whatever violations the government alleged, it had to prove each of them beyond a reasonable doubt, or at least three of them beyond a reasonable doubt. And so the Supreme Court interpreted that phrase, series of violations, to mean that the government had to prove both the series and the violations. However many are identified in their indictment, they had to prove those beyond a reasonable doubt to establish then the requisite series. So what the court said is violations is itself a separate element. And whenever you have an element of the offense in federal trials, in the vast majority of states, not all the states, but in the vast majority of the states, including Michigan, the jury's decision on the elements of the crime must be unanimous. Now, there are a few states that allow juries to vote 11 to 1, 10 to 2. The lowest that the Supreme Court has allowed is 9 to 3, and it's also said that on a six-person jury, it has to be unanimous. You can have a six-person criminal jury. But in the federal system, and in, again, the vast majority of the states, the defendant must be found guilty by a unanimous jury. And so in this case, the key was, in Richardson, what did the jury have to agree on beyond a reasonable doubt? They had to agree on both the series, that there were enough violations to constitute the series, and then the actual violations themselves identified in the government's charging document. Now, is that true for every element of a crime? Well, you do have this issue of venue. And the Jones case, Jones versus State, involving Georgia, Georgia has interpreted its law and its constitution to require proof of venue beyond a reasonable doubt, so just like any other element of the crime. At the federal level and in the majority of the states, the proof of venue only has to be established by a preponderance of the evidence. Why? Because this is just one facet of the case. It is considered an element of the case in the federal system and in most states, but in fact it's just the authority of the court to move forward. It's not really part of the crime. At least that's how the courts have justified imposing a lower burden of proof for a venue, and that being by a preponderance of the evidence. And indeed, California takes a very different approach. It's not even a jury issue. It is simply decided by the judge. So when you hear proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the elements, just note that in many jurisdictions, venue doesn't require proof beyond a reasonable doubt, even though it's an element of the crime.